Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 542. Tragically, it is the episode covering the end of the racing season for 2017. My name is Martin Darlington. I'm very happy to be back. And joining me is Jim McDowell, right across the pond in the States. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Martin. It's late here, but it's never too late to talk racing.
And it's early here, but I've got coffee, so that's okay.
All good.
Yep, we're going to talk about the final round of Moto3, Moto2, MotoGP, and wrap up the season. And we've also got the final two interviews I managed to get from World Superbike. Ronald Tencarter, I mean, flipping legend, been around that paddock forever, it seems. He's been around that paddock since sort of the days of Fogarty, I think. And really good chat. And also we spoke to Yiğit Top. It's spelled Yiğit, but it's pronounced Yiğit Top. And that's Turkey's Eurosport commentator, a lovely guy, close friend of Kenan Sofoglu. And we'll have a chat with those. We'll drop those in after we've spoken about the topical stuff like the racing.
I'm looking forward to the Ronald Tencarter interview. Those ones that you've done so far from there are fantastic. So I'm really looking forward to that one.
It's strange that the team bosses are all so... Well, the ones I've spoken to, so Hervé Poncharal, Lucio Ceccanello is always brilliant, hoping to get him again at the test at Qatar in March. Paul Denning last year at World Supers, and Ronald Tencarter, they're really open, and they're very, very practiced at the PR thing, I know that, but it doesn't feel like PR talk. You know, it's just, they're just chatting away, and yeah, he was really, really nice guy, actually. Before we go on, errata and updates and news, it's not errata, but I'm just going to encourage our wonderful listeners to pop across and try my new podcast. It's been running nearly a year now, historybyhollywood.com. We're now up to episode 21 due out this Sunday, and we're doing a supplementary looking at a brief look at 11 movies that, whilst inspired by true events, don't keep close enough to the facts to justify a whole episode. And there's also a few historical stories that are begging for a movie to be made about them but haven't been yet. So previous episodes we've done Gladiator, Rush, which is Formula One, but it's a great film about the 76 Hunt and Lauda season. Glory, Seabiscuit, Selma, Apollo 13, Amadeus, Good Morning Vietnam. You know, we've done a bunch. Sound of Music, there's a good old variety, so you can get us through iTunes, Podbean, SoundCloud, YouTube, all of which can be found on the links page on the HPH website, and it's free. So that's historybyhollywood.com, and I'm on Twitter also. Obviously I'm at MotopodMartin, but we're also on there as at historybyhwood. So anyway, that's my plug. Harry will probably edit it out, so if you didn't hear that, ignore it, okay?
No, actually, I've listened to a couple of your History by Hollywoods. I listened to Rush because I am a Formula One fan. I found it interesting. A lot of it I knew because I am a Formula One fan. Yeah. But I thought you guys did a really good job with that one. I wouldn't have given it a 7 for entertainment. I would have given it probably like a 5. But I'm an anorak, so I want to hear the cars and hear the sounds. And I thought that was kind of missing in it. Not like Frankenheimer's Grand Prix or McQueen's Le Mans. Yeah. And I also listened to Apollo 13, which I thought you guys did a really good job on that one too, except for, I'm sure you know this, but it wasn't Apollo 8 that the astronauts died on, it was Apollo 1 on the ground, because Lovell actually flew 8.
Yeah, I know. That came out in the errata of the intro to the following episode. It was like, dope. We had a couple of proper space anoraks who wrote in, which was great. And, it's always appreciated when people put you right. Now, we've had some news, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
And Silverstone confirmed for the next 3 years as the venue for the British MotoGP. Not the most exciting track, but the facilities are what you'd expect at MotoGP round. Donington, take note, that's why you didn't get it. And it can make for some good racing.
Yeah, Port Mayo is said to be trying to join the MotoGP calendar in 2019. The Kimi Ring in Finland is already confirmed as joining in 2019. So it's interesting to see where Port Mayo may fit in that. although it is a great track. I would love to see MotoGP there.
Oof, yeah.
But the since there is the given political crisis in Spain, in the Catalan area, that maybe Barcelona is on the outs. So much this space. I'm sure we'll learn more as we go along.
I mean, it's funny. I really don't like Valencia as a track. I've been there, and for the spectators, yes, you know, most of you can see most of the track for the whole race, but it just doesn't make for good racing. Yet, Valencia, I think, have just renewed. Jerez have renewed. Aragon is a great track, even though it's in the middle of nowhere. I can't see which of the Spanish rounds would get chopped, but I can't see where they're going to squeeze Portimao in. I mean, we've got Thailand joining for 2018, then Kimi Ring is joining in 2019. There's got to be some give somewhere, and a European round is, you know, prime, but which one? That's weird. Yeah. And
there's got to be something in Spain, I would think.
It's got to be, hasn't it? And at least if it's in Portugal, then, I don't know, maybe they go for the geographically closest race to Portugal, which I suppose would be Valencia. I wouldn't be sorry to see Valencia go, but like I said, I think they've just extended. I think they've got 5 years, so can't see where that's going to go.
Nope.
World Superbike news. Now, this is interesting, because Frenchman Loris Baz, obviously in exile now from MotoGP, is going back to World Superbikes, and he's been employed by Altea BMW Racing. BMW are mooted to be coming in with a full factory effort from 2019 and a brand new, you know, root and branch rebuild of the S1000RR. So he could place himself in a good position. Altea haven't had much success. I expected him to go to Honda, I must admit, because I don't expect Stefan Bradl to be returning. And you'd have had Leon Camu and Loris Baz. They're both six-footers, so they could have developed a much bigger bike. I don't know. But yeah, it's been confirmed Baz is off to Altea, so it should be interesting. He's a good rider.
That'd be great.
And of course, him and Tom Sykes can renew their hate-hate relationship.
Yes, that they can do.
Right. Valencia, Moto 3. What were your thoughts going into this? Because obviously Juan Mir has already been confirmed as champion, and the script said Jorge Martin, especially when he got pole, was finally going to win a race. Because that, I think, if it wasn't for Juan Mir, Jorge Martin would be certainly the second half of the season, he would be the standout rider in Moto 3 to get everyone's attention. He's just been a bit eclipsed by this incredible lad, you know, Mir coming through and dominating.
Yeah, I was looking at it from the standpoint of Mir has this chance to tie Rossi's record for most number of wins in a season in the class. Right now, he had 10 going into the race, which ties in with Marc Marquez and Gresini, believe it or not. So that was something to watch. I did want to see Martin win a race just because of the fact that I thought he needed the confidence boost to say, yes, I can beat Juan Mir. So there was a little bit of intrigue there going into the race.
Yeah, sure. And it was a good race. Now, I only saw this in patches. So I don't know if I was actually at work sneakily watching it on my iPad whilst this went on. Oh. Because, of course, our working week here in Qatar is Sunday to Thursday, so it's a bit of a pain. But yeah. I got home in time for Moto2 and MotoGP. But, yeah, thoughts on the race, Jim?
Yeah. So, basically, Martin is on pole. He's won his ninth pole of the year. And everybody is on the medium tire. The lights go green, and then it's Martin, Rodrigo, Mir, Bassini, and Sasaki. It's a really calm race by Moto3 standards. There's not a lot of passing and banging and going back and forth, but the front three are definitely starting to slowly pull away from fourth place. Then we kind of get to where Rodrigo crashes at turn 8, and Mir has to avoid him, and he does it by running through the kitty litter. So now Rodrigo went way over the high side. He was in deep, back end came around and just flicked him to the high, to the moon. And then once he got done and Mir got through on the kitty litter, he rejoins the race in 19th place. So Martin has a 1.6 second lead as a result of this crash. Martin then continues the lead, but it grows his lead out to like about 3 seconds. So it's Martin, Bassini, Ramirez, and DG Antonio, who then crashes into Ramirez on the front stretch. He literally misjudged the draft going into turn one. Ooh. And he winds up going smack into the back of the bike. Now, he was a very lucky boy because when he fell to the left. So he fell away from the wall, and he fell away from the progression of the traffic that would be coming from behind with him. When I first saw it, I had an instant flashback to my old dirt track days, to the Springfield Mile in about 1989 or maybe 1990 when Joel Green was there. He was in a draft pack with about five or six bikes. He went up the inside, misjudged it between the wall and another bike, was then flung into the wall and then flung out onto the track, where sadly he lost his life as he was run over by the trailing motorcycles in the pack.
Jeez.
So when I saw this happen to GD Antonio, that was the first thing I thought, and I was just praying that nobody came along and hit him.
Yeah.
And that everything was going to be okay. Luckily it was. He just simply slid to the inside, miraculously gets up, gets back on his bike, and continues on his way, as almost as if nothing had actually happened. But he did pull into the pits, and he did. And it was said by Dylan Gray that he had lost the left foot peg on the motorcycle. So yeah. He needed to go get a lottery ticket, because that was a very, very scary crash. And it goes to show you that we're talking about millimeters worth of precision here. And I talked about this about the draft before. It's very difficult to see where you're going, to find your brake markers, and to judge it all just exactly perfectly. It takes the best of the best to do it, and even the best of the best sometimes make a mistake, which is what happened to DG Antonio.
Yeah. You think about the accidents that do happen that, you know, awfully do lead to rider fatalities, and between Daijiro Kato and Luis Salom, all of them were hit by following bikes. That's the danger, isn't it, when they come back into the track or they stay in the track and the guys behind have absolutely nowhere to go. Horrendous. It always amazes me. You watch these kids, you know, throwing themselves at the ground sometimes, and they just get up and walk away angrily, or pick the bike up, shake the gravel out of the belly pan, and they're going again. You just think, yeah, you kids aren't normal. I'd be needing to lie down somewhere for a while. Mir's push back through the pack, though, was pretty impressive.
Yes, it was. So after the GD Antonio crash, Martin is now over 4 seconds in front of Fanati, who has a big out-of-the-seat moment at turn 13. Somehow he just lands back on the seat, feet back on the pegs, and keeps going. But Mir has now been racing through the pack from the 19th position that he came back onto the track in following his excursion off track. And he's got his way up to where he's now about 2 seconds behind the big group of Ramirez, Guevara, Foggia, Suzuki, Fanati, Canet, and Suzuki. And the question then becomes, well, can he pass them all? Is he going to be able to get through all of this? So he does get caught up to the battle for the final podium positions, because there's a really good dice that's happening between Foggia, Bastianini, and Ramirez that basically causes them to cut each other's lines off and slows them down that little bit. And now Mir is right there, and he's in eighth. With 5 laps to go, Mir has come through the pack, and he's now made his way up to second place. That is truly an amazing ride by the youngster.
Yeah.
What I would call a champion's ride, you know, proving that his world title was justified, and as if there wasn't any reason to doubt that he should be champion. But it was truly amazing to watch him come through the pack like he did. Spotting those guys that much distance on a Moto 3 bike is incredible.
No, exactly. And especially at that track. That is not an easy track to pass at.
No, no, it's not. It is a go-kart track. It reminds me of like a nice, slick, nasty little short track, dirt track race in the U.S. where it's slick, it's nasty, and the guy out front is going to ride slow and makes the shortest distance, and you got to try to knock him off that little groove just to get by.
Yeah.
So it's a difficult track to pass on as well.
Fanati, I think, is an interesting case this season because he, you know, I think a lot of people thought when Sky VR 46 dropped him, you thought, okay, well, that's probably the last we've seen of him. He might come back in the lower team and you know, struggle, and then one day we'll say, do you remember that Romano Fanati? You know, I mean, it's hard to realise how young he still is because he seems to have been around for ages, but of course he started at 16. And that incredible race at Mugello where Jules was so impressed by his pugilistic stances. Remember, he whipped round the warm-up lap, sat on the grid on his own with his arms folded, and as someone pointed out, and his tyres going cold. But he really has been rejuvenated this season.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he has. I mean, he was actually going for a record 24th class podium, which says something to the guy's testament, to the guy's riding ability. He was actually having a really good race in the dry. You know, Fanati, the last few races have been in the rain, Misano, Motegi, and I have waxed poetically about how good he is in the rain, but it just really hasn't translated into the dry. This one, it kind of did. He was definitely there with a shout, but he's moving on to Moto2 next year, along with Wanier.
Yeah, I know. I'll tell you what, Moto2 next year, with these lads coming up, the KTM team of Oliveira and Binder still there. Alex Marquez with another season under his belt, and he's, you know, definitely a front runner now. A great team at Mark VDS, although I've got a horrible feeling he will spend a lot of time being the second place teammate again. And we've got people like Hector Barbera going down, and of course Hector Barbera's never ridden Moto2. He was 250s, so I think next season could be really interesting in Moto2. And we might move on to Moto2 at this point. Anything else on Moto3?
I was just going to finish it off here. So on the last lap, Fanati and Ramirez are fighting for that podium, but it's Martin who wins. Ramirez come from 19th to finish second on the podium, and Ramirez then holds off Fanati. So it's an all-Spanish podium, which the fans there would definitely like. And of note, with Mir's second place, it is a record points haul for the class. His 341 points is the greatest total amassed by a world champion in the class ever. So,
yeah, it's impressive, but of course we're probably racing more races than we ever have before, so that the points total thing is kind of like, and I kept meaning to look back at you because someone said about Johnny Ray beating Colin Edwards' record in World Superbikes, and it was like, yeah, but how many races did they do then and how many now? And someone on Twitter said, oh no, it's the same amount, it's 26 races, 13 rounds, 26 races. So I'd have to check on that, but I've forgotten to, so maybe someone out there will know. Dr. Martin Raines, and it's probably worth saying, I mean, wow, what, there's going to be such a change next season to the information we get and who we listen to. If you listen to BT Sport, you'll no longer hear Julian Ryder, who's retired. Julian, I think, you know, he splits the fans. Some people find him a little bit pompous. Some people just love his knowledge. But he's definitely been an institute in that paddock for many, many seasons. He's retiring. Of course, Nick Harris from Dorna, who introduces every press conference, does the main commentary with Matt Burt. Nick's retiring, and we've also lost Dr. Martin Raines as Dorna's statistician. And, you know, you could tweet, oh, when was the last time we had, you know, no Spaniards on the podium or something? And often within a minute, Dr. Martin Raines is back with, oh, well, it was in 2008, and it was this, whatever. You're like, wow. So there's some real losses in the back room or the interface between us and the racing for next season. So absolute hats off to all three of those gentlemen.
I think Dylan Gray is leaving the pit lane as well. I was reading something about that on Twitter, how he was chasing other aspirations. So he's not even going to be there.
And that's a shame, because he knows what he's talking about, Dylan. He's been a real breath of fresh air, I think. He's been very good.
I agree. I like Dylan. I think he's had some timely information, had some good input. I mean, it's kind of hard to run up and down the pit lane and try to figure all the stuff out that he does. And it's good information for all of us race fans. So he's going to be missed. It's going to be hard shoes to fill.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And just thinking about the Dorna feed, of course, we've got our own Harry and Steve English at Crossing World Superbikes. And Steve Day, who people might be familiar with, is moving up in the MotoGP side to take over from Nick Harris. And I kind of feel really sorry for Steve, because you just know there's lots of people who don't like change, and he's going to get pelters from people who are like, no, I don't want this. I don't want him. And you think, well, who do you want? Well, I want Nick Harris. Yeah, but he's retired. So it is going to change. And Steve is knowledgeable. He's enthusiastic. It's a very different style from Nick. But, you know, the question would always be, well, who do you want instead? Who's out there? I don't know. I think in a little way, Steve is facing the sort of task that whoever replaces Valentino Rossi at Yamaha when he finally retires will face. People will be like, well, he's not Rossi. Well, no, obviously he's not. But I wish him all the best, because I really enjoy... Steve already covers a lot of the Moto3, Moto2 sessions, and he's a good commentator, and he's entertaining, and he's passionate, and I think you can't ask for more than that.
No, you can't. So it's going to be different, but the racing will be good, and I think we'll all adapt and adjust.
Oh, it's going to be the best season ever.
Always is.
Always is. At least until it starts. So, Moto2, and Michael Bartolomei, the team principal of Mark VDS, looked like the cat who got the cream on Saturday afternoon. He had Alex Marquez, one of his riders, on pole, Franco Morbidelli, world champion, his other rider on the middle of the front row, and Mattia Pessini in third, completing the front row. The KTM pair of Oliveira and Binder were with Dominic Agata on the second row. Taka Nakagami, there you go, Dave, he loves saying that, Taka Nakagami, Francesco Bagnaia, Pecco Bagnaia, and Xavi Fierge were on the third row. So qualifying kind of, you know, pretty much went with form. There were no huge surprises missing, and there were no huge surprises in there. Those KTMs, though, wow. I love the fact that this company, who in Moto3 for a few years have been the rival to Honda, are quite happy to come in and say, yeah, no, we'll use a Honda engine because everyone's got to, but we want a team in each class, therefore we're going to build a KTM frame, put a Honda engine in it, but no one calls it a KTM Honda. You know, can you imagine Yamaha entering Moto2 accepting a Honda engine? Because I just can't.
No, I don't think it would. It wouldn't work. I mean, if there's one thing I know about KTM is that they're racers and they just want to go racing.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah. And I mean, in one season, that they've just turned this brand new bike into a race winner. They've got two fantastic riders. I think if Brad hadn't been injured earlier in the season or the beginning of the season, I think he'd be a lot further up the points table, obviously. And you just got to love Miguel Oliveira. I think he is definitely a, you know, borderline special talent. Albeit Franco Morbidelli's done a great job this season.
Yeah, I agree. I think Oliveira is definitely a talent. He's a guy on the up. You know, next year, he's sort of the presumptive favorite for the championship. And KTM is looking to be the bike to be on.
Yeah.
Unless that, what's it, you know, come out with something different. And, Skyler and I have had this conversation, but this is white WP suspension. It's not Orleans. So if they have something that nobody else has, i.e. that suspension, they have a great chance of actually being fast and being really good. And that's a competitive edge. So it's all sort of working in their favor, but it will be interesting to see there's like going to be six KTMs on the grid next year to see what the other KTMs have, if they have the WP suspension or if they have an Olin's or if they have a choice. So that's my interest in that one.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I do find it quite reminiscent of Motopod's founder, or MotoGPOD as it was at the time, Bob Hayes. And Bob had this theory of the 2007 series being the perfect storm of the Ducati, Casey Stoner, and Bridgestone. And of course, Ducati said, look, we needed something, we needed an edge on Rossi, and the only thing we could get was to have something different. So they decided to go with Bridgestone, and it just happened that Bridgestone, of course, this was back in the days for our younger listeners, where you had Michelin's, Bridgestone's, and sadly for Tech 2 and Dunlop's at the back of the grid. You know, it was an open tyre as much as it was an open manufacturer competition, and it worked. So yeah, maybe they've found something. This could be WP's way in. I mean, think about the early days of Moto 2, where Suter was the chassis to have, and what we got now, four of them, I think, on the grid, something like that, four or five. Everyone's on Kalex.
I think you're right.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. So the race was, it wasn't a fairing, bashing, back to the axe murderer class type crazy race, but it was really, really tense and exciting as Morbidelli got out front and was slowly and surely hunted by the unflappable, non-mistake-making Miguel Oliveira.
Yes, that's sort of how it worked. It was definitely Morbidelli's race to lose, and just the KTMs just came on. And like we've said numerous times on the show, they have figured out their ills and their problems. So they have on a good footing. They've got a good base set up, I think, now. And the impressive thing to me was that we saw them win in Phillip Island, a track that kind of goes for the rider. He makes a lot of difference in there, because even bikes that are slow seem to somehow be magically fast there. And I think it's just because of the fact that everybody's on the throttle for so long.
Then with
the Sepang, and they did it again with another 1-2, and this time they qualified even better than they did at Phillip Island. So, again, a track with some very long straightaways, but also it's there's a lot of nuance to that track, especially through the first two turns and then sort of like the 4-5-6 section of the track. And they made that work for them in the heat. So they obviously had their head around whatever they needed to make the tires last and make them work. And now they've showed up in Valencia on a track that's completely different than anything that we've been to. Very stop, very start, no flow, always on the edge of the tire, where you've got to have edge grip, where you have to accelerate on the edge of the tire, and you have to be able to brake well on the edge of the tire. And they made it look simple again.
Yeah.
KTM has really come a long way fast in these last 3-4 races. And they just needed some little sprinkle of magical ingredient. And when they got it, and it, they've just held on to it, and it's impressive.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Looking forward to next season immensely, especially in the Moto2 class, because it will be great to see how they get on. The Alex Marquez had another, I think, you know, he came fifth. It's not bad, but I think he probably felt a bit deflated, and he got pipped by Pecco Bagnaia at the end. And he just really
I think Marquez was suffering from a rear grip problem. I think he just either got the tire wrong or used it up or just didn't have the bike set to where he likes it. And it showed, because he was getting beat off the final turn. That's a place where you want to have a strong drive, and you need to be able to get there and then outbreak your opponent into turn one.
Yeah, I mean, looking a little bit further down the grid as well, we've got Morbidelli's coming up to MotoGP, and then the seventh place finisher Taka Nakagami coming up to join Cal Crutchlow at LCR Honda. Of course, both of them having their wages paid by HRC. Cal, because he's taken the Jack Miller satellite HRC slot, and Nakagami being a Japanese rider. So that's allowed Lucio Ceccanello and his team to field two bikes. Fabio Quartararo finished eighth. Now for him, that's been a really good finish. Probably one of the disappointments of the season for me, but then he has been for the last two seasons, so I don't really expect much from Quartararo anymore. He arrived in Moto3 with all this fanfare, and to me he just hasn't translated it into results. Now, whether he manages to or not, I don't know.
Yeah, not too sure what to make of that with Quartararo. I mean, there's flashes of brilliance, but it's not consistent. Marquez, he has flashes of brilliance. He's won two races this year. But both of them run hot and cold, and I just don't know what it is. I don't know if it's a setup thing or exactly what it is that they don't quite yet have figured out. But they have the potential, both of them, to be at the front consistently, and we're just not seeing it right now. So,
yeah, it's identifying where the problem is.
Yes, where is the problem? That is the problem.
But you know, he's on the bike that last year we saw Alex Rins come damn close to taking the title on. You know, it's not a slow bike. So, yeah, be interesting to see how he progresses. And down in the DNFs with Xavier Simeon, who is coming up to MotoGP next season. And I do understand it's a business, and I do understand that satellite bikes, when they've got a rider, can bring a huge amount of personal sponsorship. I'm not quite sure how or why Xavier Simeon can, but I think he's 20th or 21st in the final standings. Our standings for Moto2 don't go down far enough to find Simeon. So, well, we'll see how he gets on next season, but I really aren't expecting much. And I just think it's a shame to see Hector Barbera and Loris Bowers and the like getting flicked, and someone being brought in who really isn't showing any reason to bring him into MotoGP other than he brings a lot of money with him.
Yeah, I don't like that either, but it's a business, and if there's no money to go racing, then we don't get anything to watch. So
no, exactly. It's a bit like the team orders thing, which no doubt we'll come on to shortly. Final standings, Franco Morbidelli finished, obviously, as champion. Tom Luthi did hold on to second place, as we knew he did, despite Miguel Oliveira's race win, but he finished only 2 points behind Tom Luthi, who wasn't there because of his injury. And Alex Marquez obviously finished fourth, quite a distant fourth, with Pecco Bagnaia fifth in the title standings. MotoGP, the big class. We knew the title was 90% likely to go to Marquez. Dovi still had a chance, but that, you look back at that Phillip Island race where he was pipped by Redding and, was it Lorenzo? I can't remember. Two of them just pipped him to the line, which cost him 2 points, which would have made the difference between having to win and being able to come second if, of course, Marquez DNF'd. And there was so much tension going into this weekend. Some subplots got missed. Maverick Vinales failed to get through QP1 or Q1. We had the Espargaro brothers on their KTM and Aprilia respectively got through, and Marquez got the pole. I mean, it's typical Marquez weekend. Crashed in free practice, then he gets pole position, or he gets a really fast lap, then he crashes in Q2, but he still gets cut pole position on the strength of that incredible blinking lap he did of 129. Zarco and Ian Oni on the front row with him though, and he must have been thinking, no, anyone but those two. Ian Oni's had a terrible season, so he's really motivated. Zarco's come close to winning races and hasn't yet, so he's really motivated, and he's like, yeah, great. On the plus side for Marquez, Dovi was down at the back of the third row in ninth, so you know, he needed to get a really good start, and off the start, blinkin' heck, Marquez wheeled, and yet still managed to not lose too many positions.
Yeah, he...
Sorry, I'm pausing for you to dive in with anything.
That's fine. I want to just back to qualifying real quick. Marquez has crashed 27 times this year. Stop and try to wrap your head around that for a second. This guy is the guy leading the world championship, the guy who is probably going to win the world championship, but he has been on the ground 27 times. Freddie Spencer was
Did you read the interview with him about this? And he said, no, it's this is it. Matt Oxley did a brilliant column, and he talked about there's an edge, then a ledge. He goes over the edge, but then he finds a ledge, and these saves he keeps making are just incredible. I mean, other racers are saying, no, that I wouldn't have saved that. He's gone. He's finished. He's down. But he's not. He somehow lifts it back up with knee and elbow and carries on. Dobby's crashed 6 times in all sessions all season, which is what you'd think from a title contender you expect to see. Like you say, Marquez, 27 times. I mean, the comparisons, the stats, the record breaking, and just the kid himself, he just keeps pushing the envelope of what we find amazing further and further.
Freddie Spencer had a great comment on Marquez's 27 crashes. He said that he tried to think back to his entire Grand Prix career, and he doesn't think he crashed 27 times in his career in the Grand Prix circuit.
Yeah.
So that tells you just how different Marquez is with a motorcycle. So it is amazing. Also, I think with the fact that after qualifying, you wound up with the good. Okay, Marquez is on pole and Dovi is 9th. The bad, Zarco is next to him. And then the ugly, that's the Iannone right next to him, Zarco. So you could see, or you had the impression or the feeling that this is going to be a really scrappy first 3 turns. And then it becomes, well, who's got the balls to go charging up on the inside of the 4th turn, which is now your first right-hander after the 3 lefts? And who's going to feel like they can make it stick? So the setup was really ready for some great racing and some drama to begin with. But Marquez makes that absolutely brilliant start, and he's out front.
Yeah, I mean, Danny Pedrosa got a good start as well. And, he got duffed a little bit by Zarco, but Pedrosa quite early got tucked in behind Marquez in front, and you know, Nick Harrison, Matt Burt was saying, wow, that is a teammate. He's flying wingman to Marquez and giving him some protection. That didn't last that long, though, did it? Because the crazy frog, as some of my mates like to call him, Johann Zarco, who objected to me suggesting to him last year or earlier this year that he was ever crazy, but he is definitely aggressive, and he got past Danny Pedrosa. And then we had this, we didn't see it on the live shot, did we? We saw Zarco go past Marquez, and it was like, well, that was easy. And then on the replay, you saw Marquez looked over his shoulder, and he moved off the racing line. And that's what's scary, is yes, Marquez is an absolute balls out, I want to win every race, but he's also clever and aware, and he's like, I'm not messing with this kid. And I think Zarco knew that. I think Zarco thought, if I can get behind Marquez if he's in the lead and show him a wheel, he's going to get out of the way, because he does not want to get into a fight with me, because he's looking
for me. No, I agree. I think Zarco is thinking that way. And, you know, for Zarco, he's trying to do something that no other satellite Yamaha rider has done, and that's win a race. So that's motivation for Zarco to go in the front and try to go on there. And watching the replay and seeing Marquez actually look back and see Zarco and get off the racing line, it's like you said, it's very scary. Marquez is not just thinking with his right wrist. He's actually using his brain that, hey, I don't need to be involved in this. I just need to ride this thing home and everything will be fine.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was just so controlled. Meanwhile, behind them, you had Danny Pedrosa in the third podium position, holding station, but not really on the back wheel of Marquez. And then you had Lorenzo, followed by Dovi, and this is where, obviously, there's been some controversy. For a good few laps, Dovi looked faster. He looked right on the tail of Lorenzo, but as we know with Valencia, it's not an easy track to pass at, especially when, you know, if you'd been behind a Honda or a Yamaha or a Suzuki, you'd think he'd outdrag them on the straight, but he's behind the other factory Ducati, so he couldn't. And then we saw suggested mapping 8 on his dash text message thing, also on the pit board with a down arrow. You saw Lorenzo's pit crew sort of shrugging his shoulders and looking apologetic to Dovi's pit crew, as if to say, we're telling him he's not doing it, and Lorenzo was not giving up the place. I don't know, do we want to just wrap that one up on the whole team orders thing? Or
we can go through team orders there if we want. That's fine. I mean, because my question to you is this. You have stated that, you know, you have firmly planted your flag in Lorenzo land. I mean, what is your take on it with him? Do you now not like Lorenzo, or is it like, it's a racing thing and I'm still a fan?
The thing about the Lorenzo fandom really grew out of going to Catalunya GP most years with a huge group of Rossi fans who would not accept that anybody can ever beat Rossi unless they cheat. And one of the things I loved about Lorenzo as a racer was he was the first person who could challenge Rossi on the same equipment. There was nowhere for Rossi to hide. How did Rossi respond? He won the 2008 and 2009 titles. So, yeah, test passed, legendary status cemented. So I've got no issue with Valentino Rossi at all. I have an issue with some of his fans, who I think are cult of personality fans rather than racing fans. Lorenzo as an individual is difficult to like, and I've never really been a fan of any particular racer over any other. I'm a fan of racing, but it became a bit of a meme, particularly on Motopod, because it wound people up and it became a talking point and it generated debate. So yeah, I used to do that. Yeah, I'll wear the Lorenzo shirt and the hat and all this sort of thing. I don't really like the guy, but he is an incredible racer to watch. On the team orders thing, I don't like them. But I do understand, back to what we were saying about Xavier Simeon coming up to MotoGP without having earned it through his race results. I accept it's, you know, the reality of a business, that they want their team to do the best they can. And a lot of racers have said it's not about team orders, it's about being a teammate. And Lorenzo's pretty much got universal pelters from anyone expressing an opinion, except the team have said, no, it's just a suggestion. And Dovi said, no, his idea was, he's explained to me, he was trying to drag me up to Danny, but that didn't really work. So, you know, Lorenzo, I think at Sepang, definitely let Dovi through, and nearly crashed in the process. Here, I don't know what his thinking was. I've heard it suggested by some paddock insiders that not much thinking goes on under that X-marked helmet. That he's just got a pure instinct rider. I don't know. I really don't. I don't think Lorenzo would have thought he was able to win the race, so I can't see the reason why he wouldn't swap fourth for fifth for a mate who is chasing a teammate who's chasing the world championship.
Yeah, I'm on the side of, I don't like team orders. I wish that they weren't there. But I, like you, I agree. It's a business, and there is the what if. So I agree that is Ducati's decision. As a company, as a business, it is their decision. And I don't write the contracts for the riders. I don't know what their contracts say. But What got me with it was Lorenzo had openly said, I will help my teammate if he needs it, in the last round. Well, here's a classic case where your teammate needed the help, and yet you didn't help him. You were hurting him.
No.
Because Dobie, I think, knew that it was an uphill battle. I think he needed a miracle, okay? But the Ducati is not a good bike for Valencia because you're forced to have to – it doesn't want to turn mid-corner. So you have to ride on the edge of the tire and rely on edge grip a lot more than if you're on a Honda, if you're on a Yamaha. So that trying to get by and trying to work past Lorenzo basically shagged off whatever edge grip Dobie had on his tires to where he didn't have any grip anymore. And I think that was, you know, we know that Gigi Delinea and Lorenzo have a history with each other. They won 250 world titles for Aprilia together. I think Lorenzo was looking at it from the standpoint of, I am going to put my stamp on this team that, hey, this is my team. I'm the number one rider, and the guy who's designing the bike is my best buddy. So I'm sorry, Dobie. I am the heir apparent to the Casey Stoner throne, if you will, and it's not you.
Yeah.
Is that ego, baby? Is it just Lorenzo? Is it what any rider would do? Who knows?
Positioning your place in a team, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, that would imply a degree of long-term strategy being applied. And like I say, this was a discussion with a long-standing team member, Paddock Insider, who we were talking about when Rossi plays mind games with people, and it used to really work and it doesn't anymore. And his point was, well, this generation of racers grew up watching him play those games, so they came prepared. He said Stoner got angry, didn't get slower. Marquez, it just doesn't seem to bother him at all. He finds it quite funny. And, you know, okay, he's reacted a couple of times, 2015 notably. But then, so did Rossi. And then we said, what about Lorenzo? And he said, I'm not sure he's bright enough to know when he's being insulted or wound up. So, yeah, I'm not sure how much cerebral activity was going on or whether it was just stubbornness of... I have heard a couple of people have said, yeah, but Dovi then dropped back, so actually Lorenzo did have the better pace. But as you've said, Dovi probably wrecked his tyres trying to get past, and then by the time he did and Lorenzo went down, it was too late. So, spoiler alert, Lorenzo crashed. But before that, we'd seen Mark Marquez crashed, but it was a Marquez crash, so it's a crash where he doesn't actually crash. Gets into the gravel, comes back out, and I think he was fourth or fifth. Was he behind? Yeah, he was behind Rins, wasn't he? He was behind the Ducatis. Mm-hmm. Dovi sees a bit of hope. Lorenzo obviously thinks, right, okay, we've got to go now, and crashes almost immediately, followed a couple of turns later by Dovi crashing and out. And unfortunately, that was it.
Yes. It was interesting. This sequence happened so fast in the race that it was like bang, 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 bang. What happened here? Hold on, let's stop and analyze it all. Zarco was out front, and basically he was losing some pace. And I was thinking, since he was on the soft tire and Marquez was on the medium, they're both on softs, but maybe he had used up some of that tire because the Yamahas have been hard on tires this year. So Marquez is starting to not necessarily run a faster pace. His lap times are pretty stagnant, but Zarco is slowing down. So Marquez kind of looked at this and, well, the right hand overruled the brain and said, well, I can win this. I'm not going to be going any faster than I am right now. So he sets Zarco up beautifully in turn 13. They head down the front stretch, and Marquez is up front, but he's fearing that Zarco is going to go nutso on the brakes going into one. So Marquez, he even admits after the race, I kind of blanked out for a second, and I lost my track of where I was, and I braked way too late. And so when he did, he consequently had come and almost crashed, like you said. Well, we didn't know that it actually happened because they had cut away in the live feed. They had cut to some other battle that was going on. We just saw Marquez running back onto the track, and it was only in replay that you saw how incredible of a save it was, because Marquez had gone in there.
Yeah.
He had folded the front. The front was gone. You can see the black mark that the front tire lays from the beginning of that corner all the way through to where he just gets to the outside where the paint is, and he somehow snaps it back up. And he said, well, I was going to go all the way with the bike. I still had the rear tire on the ground, so everything was okay. So, okay, you're doing 170 miles an hour. You're crashing. You have your right foot is off the foot peg. Yet this kid has enough mental capacity left over in spare change to go, oh, well, wait a minute. I still have traction at the rear. I can save this. Just the laws of physics do not apply.
I love that thing he said. He said, I decided to stay with her. You know, talking about the bike, he said, no, we were going to go down together or survive together. I was going to stay with her. So, and it's like, but this is back to, remember Mugello a couple of years ago where he realised, oh, I'm actually going off the track here and there's a wall, I better get off at 209 miles an hour. And it's like, this kid's speed of thought and decision making is just absolutely phenomenal. So he comes back up, as you said, very quickly we lose Lorenzo and Dovi, and there were some lovely scenes of Dovi coming back into the paddock and his mechanics just all around him. He's such a calm, philosophical individual. He was like, he gave a little smile and a shrug to the camera. He must have been absolutely gutted, but as he said over the last couple of months, you know, this has been my best season ever, so I'm not complaining. So we had Zarco at the front, then Pedrosa and then Marquez, and poor old Danny Pedrosa, kind of the forgotten man often. I was thinking, because I've got a couple of French colleagues I work with who are very into MotoGP, and obviously they love Zarco, and I was picturing them thinking, yes, Zarco's going to get his first win, and then Danny just started chipping and chipping and chipping, and he looked so... He didn't look like he was riding fast. Whereas Zarco was making shapes, and you just have that feeling, sorry, Johan, you're going to have to wait another year.
It was a very nice pass that Pedrosa puts on Zarco at turning one at the beginning of the last lap. And I was kind of heartbroken because I wanted Zarco to win one. I think the guy is incredibly talented.
Yeah.
And to see him go all that way and not get it was a bit frustrating, but that is racing. There is no way around that.
Yeah. and Danny did one of those, he pulled enough of a gap that at some tracks, a third of a second he won by. At some tracks that wouldn't have been enough for someone not to have a desperate lunge pass on you, but at Valencia it is. Zarco just couldn't quite get back really up close to have a go. So, it finished Pedrosa, Zarco, Marquez, a Spanish-French sandwich. Alex Rins, fourth, great result. Rossi, fifth. My one criticism, you did say when we didn't see what happened with Marquez initially, there were an awful lot of cuts to people in garages looking tense. I'm like, they're looking tense because they're watching the race, and actually we quite like to as well, if that's okay. But, Marquez, world champion. Fourth premiership title, youngest ever to do it, beating Mike Hailwood best part of a year. He's the youngest rider of all time to reach six world championships across the three series, taking the record from Rossi, who was over a year older. Just under a year older. The only Spanish rider with more titles is Angel Nieto, and they were all in the small classes. They just go on and on and on.
There's no way to go and talk about Marquez. Until you start breaking it down into different segments like this, he is the first rider with three DNFs to win the world title since 1998 when Mick Doohan did it. As far as championships go, in the premier class, and we're not talking about overall championships, just the premier class. Agostini's got 8. Rossi has 7. Doohan has 5. Marquez has now got 4. Okay, that is some...
And he's 24.
And he's 24. He's tied with Lawson.
Look who he's tied with.
Tied with Lawson, tied with Haywood, tied with Surtees and the legendary Jeff Duke. We are talking about a kid who is in amongst the greats, or the people that us as spectators and fans of the sport would go are the legends of the sport, and he is right there with them. And it's amazing. Yeah. There's nothing that you can actually say that can actually quantify how good this kid is on a motorcycle. I mean, Doolin has five titles all on a Honda. Marquesny's won more, and he's got that record. It's just insane.
It was Mick Doohan the other day was saying, or a month or two ago, I think it was Phillip Island, where to my and many other people's disgust, Marquez got booed on the podium because he's not Valentino Rossi. Is the only explanation I can find. I can't see why people would boo such an incredible rider as that. But Doohan said, don't doubt that this kid, Doohan said that the last time he can remember this depth of competition was early 90s with Schwantz, Rainey, Doohan coming up. You know, he said that you still had, but he, that was a changeover of racing generations, and he said it was only for a season or two. He said, this kid has been against a greater depth of high level competition than anyone Mick Doohan can remember. And he's had that every season he's been in MotoGP from 2013 onwards. And he's winning. He's won four out of the last five titles. And it hasn't always been on the best bike, so let's put that one to bed. He's had good luck, bad luck, and he's adapted just incredibly from win it or bin it, and most times he still won anyway, to I'm going to secure the maximum points that I can on this day in these conditions with my talent, which generally means a race win, but it won't always. And I think your comment is absolutely spot on, that his style is revolutionary. Mm-hmm. It's not as obvious as Kenny Roberts coming over and hanging off and putting his knee down, which the British racers, when he came over to the Europe, were like, oh, we didn't know you could do that. You know, it's not as obvious, but there are things he does that have never been done before.
Yep.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
And this is like a revolutionary shift in how people are going to have to learn to ride. And it's going to take the others several years to catch up, to get back and get anywhere on the same plane as Mark is. I mean, you know, Dovey.
Well, it's almost the case, I think, of those that are most likely to adapt are the ones who are not yet in the MotoGP class. Your Juan Mir's, your Franco Morbidelli's, who are coming up, who will be watching him and thinking, okay, that's how I have to ride a MotoGP bike. I think it's a lot harder when you're a Rossi or a Lorenzo or a Pedrosa or a Dovey, where you already know how to ride a MotoGP bike really, really fast. And in Rossi and Lorenzo's case, you won world titles on it. And now you're thinking, I have to relearn? Or maybe their egos say, no, I don't. I can be quicker than him using my style. Well, the evidence suggests you're not. But I'm just going to throw out, this is a bit of a wild theory, and I am aware there's been an article this week with the team principal of Red Bull KTM saying they're very interested in Johann Zarco for 2019. I think Marquez is going to start thinking about securing his legacy, and he's going to want to remove any opportunity for anybody to say, yeah, well, you could only do it on the Honda. And I think if he wins the title next year, he may not renew for 2019. Now, he'll only be 25 next year, so, you know, he may go another round of 2 years. But given the fact that in racing terms they've got virtually unlimited resources, I would not be surprised to see Red Bull KTM make a crazy, crazy play for Marquez. I know they've denied it. It's been suggested because of his associations with Red Bull. Looking at the progression KTM have made, as you said earlier, Jim, they are racers and winners. And I think Marquez will want to do okay, Rossi, you went to a Yamaha, which was a dog. I think it hadn't I don't think you got a podium in 2003, and you won a title on it. I'm going to a bike that's virtually brand new, that's only been in the paddock for, you know, what would it be then, 2 or 3 years, and he's going to try and win on it. Because I can't see him going to Yamaha. That just turns him into Mini Rossi.
Mm-hmm. As much as I love this idea, and I would be 100% behind watching Marquez win a world title on a KTM, I don't think he does it. I think even if KTM throws crazy money at him, he's not going to move from where he is. And I don't think it's going to hurt his legendary status. For me, I look at it from this standpoint. Rossi was at basically his zenith at about around 2003. And I say that from one race because in Phillip Island he was caught passing underneath a waving yellow flag. They tacked on 10 seconds to his time. They told him on his pit board, and Rossi simply opened the tap and rode away from everybody, won the race by like 30 seconds. And I think that was one of the few times you actually saw Rossi race a race at 10 tenths. Rossi really didn't have any competition in the paddock. I mean, yeah, Biaggi was there, yeah, Giovinazzi was there, but they were not the same rider that Rossi was. Rossi needed his own personal challenge, and that was win a title on a Yamaha, and he did. That's why he went there. Marquez is riding against some of the best talent that has thrown a leg over a motorcycle right now. And not only that, look at the kids that are coming. The Juan Mirs, the Martins, the Morbidellis, the Oliveras. Those guys are going to be there in a couple years. They're going to be there. Marquez is only going to be 27 years old when they get there. He is going to face competition from people that is going to be crazy. And it's going to be crazy difficult for him to win it and keep winning. But if he does, to me, that cements his legacy as one of the greatest. He doesn't have to be on a different bike to do it. But I would love the story. Don't get me wrong. I would love the story to see it.
It's probably not going to happen. Most of my predictions don't actually come to fruition. But, yeah, I just it's a thought I had. And those who are on the inside who have run it by have sort of gone, yeah, that's not very likely. So it probably won't. But what is going to be interesting next year, of course, is we've got 19 rounds. And Thailand sounds like it might be a bit of an interesting track. Now, they're going there for the test instead of Phillip Island because, obviously, it's a new track. Apparently, it's not the most sophisticated of places in terms of facilities and the track itself, its condition. So it'll be interesting to see how that one gets on. I'm not sure how long the... I mean, obviously, it's homologated because World Superbikes have been going there for a couple of seasons now. I haven't actually seen a race from Thailand, so I don't even know which way the track goes. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
I agree.
Wrapping up the world title then, we had Marquez finished on 298 points, Dovi on 261, which looks disproportionately far back, just because of the way this final race went. Vinales comfortably third with 230, Danny Pedrosa fourth with 210, relegating Valentino Rossi to fifth on 208. Jan Zarco, top rookie, top satellite rider, brilliant season, 174. Lorenzo, 157. But I think he's getting it dialed in, and I think he will be back in podium contention at least by the early races next season, depending on the direction that they take with the Ducati.
Mm-hmm. They've got to get it to where it'll turn mid-corner a little bit easier and make a transition a little bit easier. And if they can do that through whatever means that they have available to them, then I look for Lorenzo to be quite competitive on that motorcycle. The bike is obviously capable of winning races. Dovi's done. And I think Lorenzo is equal to the riding ability of Dovi. So definitely... it's going to be interesting next year. Plus, what happens if Yamaha gets their chassis right and now they're able to use it properly?
I mean, Vinales had a terrible end to the season, but I can't see him being that poor at, you know, for the start of next season. Yeah, like you say, it depends where they go. Incidentally, interestingly as well, looking at the calendar for next year, we've got a new round in World Superbikes right near the end of the season. The penultimate round is a new track, El Villicum in Argentina, subject to homologation. It's not, the track's not completed yet. That'll be just before the Qatar final round, so it's staying at 13. And hats off to Dorna again, because they're running both series. It means they can coordinate the only clash, the only Sunday where there is both MotoGP and World Superbikes is the 22nd of April. World Superbikes are in Assen, MotoGP are in Texas at COTA, so there's several hour time difference between them. Therefore, it's not actually a problem. And in October, you have the Qatar race from World Superbikes on Saturday the 27th with MotoGP the next day. So a rich, that's in the Phillip Islands, so a rich weekend of race watching. But again, not an actual clash. So very well done, Dorna, and thank you.
Yes. Well, I want to ask you a question, Martin, with concerns Rossi and Vinales. So Vinales obviously had the hot start at the beginning of the year. It faded. There was the issue where the tire was voted on in Le Mans, different instruction on the front. But I found something. You were talking about the Rossi mind games and how everybody now knows how he plays that game. I think Rossi's found a new game to play, because I think Rossi screwed over Vinales because Rossi wanted the chassis changed. And Rossi made the comments that, hey, he doesn't know what a Yamaha is supposed to feel like, and I know that bike won't be developed properly if we use that chassis. We need to go in a different direction and use the bike the way I want it, because I know how a Yamaha is supposed to be. So I think Rossi is trying to manipulate Vinales just through different chassis and techniques. I don't think it's a direct mind game anymore so much as it's, he's basically backhanded stabbing him, to be honest. At least I think. I mean, I'm just throwing it out there.
No, no, it's a good shout. And that, certainly when that, I read that interview when he made the comments about, you know, well, he doesn't know what it's meant to feel like, and I do. I was thinking, well, he knows how a bike's meant to feel, and if he's quick on it, then he's going to like that. And, you know, but no, you're right. And supposedly at the test at Valencia, Rossi was pretty quick on the 2018 chassis, and Vinales was pretty quick on the 2016 chassis, which we knew he was quick on, because that's what they started this year testing with for him to get used to the M1 before they went on to the 2017. So, as I think it was David Emmett said, when someone said, why don't they just go back to 2016? He said, because then they'd be 2 years behind everybody else. You've got to move forward. So it's no good dialing back to an old chassis unless you then adapt that chassis in a different direction to get a 2018 back bike. You can't just go back to 2016 and hope that you're going to win on it, because you won't. Yeah, I don't know. It'll be very interesting to see how the testing goes, because, of course, Vinales absolutely dominated the close-season testing at the beginning of this year. So at the beginning of 2018, it'll be interesting to see who goes where with what. Yeah, I mean, we've had, on terms of looking forward to next year, there's a provisional British Superbike calendar is up and available to find on the net, and there's also a what's described as the tentative Moto America schedule, and supposedly they're opening in April at Road Atlanta in Braselton, Georgia, and it will close out at Barber Motorsports Park in Birmingham, Alabama, with what is that? 10 rounds. Laguna Seca date still to be announced, because they have tied in with World Supers there, haven't they? But I'm not there, going there in end of June, and I'm not sure that's, you know, that would work. So it'll probably be the same weekend as World Supers.
I agree.
Right, should we have a quick listen to Mr. Ronald Ten Carter, and that will be followed by a chat with Yeet Top, Turkey's Eurosport commentator. And Yeet's a lovely guy. He's got quite a strong accent, but his English is impeccable. He does something pretty incredible. He sits in a recording booth in Istanbul watching the world feed on World Street Bikes, on MotoGP, on I think that's the main two he covers, but he also does car racing and all sorts. He commentates on it, but he also has in one headset the English language feed. He said often they have information that's not available to me. Often they're if they're at the track, they might have a track side report that's not available to me. So he can pass information on to his Turkish listeners in Turkish, having listened to it in the other ear in English. And it's like, wow. He's an absolutely lovely guy. We befriended each other in the media centre at World Supers this year, and absolute diamond. And he's a close personal friend of Kenan Sofroli. And he introduced me to Kenan, who was limping but not horrendously, with a triple fractured hip through the paddock, beaming smiles. Any friend of Yeats is a friend of mine, and it was just like, wow. And Yeats gone home with Keenan's race gloves and these sliders to put on his wall and add to the collection. So, you know, lovely bloke. We're going to listen to those, and Jim and I will be back afterwards. Zoom zoom. It's Martin from MotoPod, and delighted to be sat down with Ronald Tencarta, the principal of Red Bull Honda Racing here in World Superbikes. You've been running a team now for, this is your 16th year, coming to the end of?
Whoa, I almost lost count on things. Well, we actually started the team back in 1994, but I was very much like privateer team, already racing with Hondas, because that's the DNA in our heart. There's a wing in my heart, I think.
Yeah.
When I take an x-ray of my body. But since 2001, we've become an official supported Honda team. So that's about 17 years now, and in total, 24 years racing. So
10 world titles. Yeah. I was there to see James Toseland get his. Yeah. And of course, you know, and such great success in the super sport.
Yeah.
Looking back, the evolution of the Fireblade, and, you know, now we've got the SP2s come out again.
Mm-hmm.
Going back all that time, you've had such a close relationship with them. Do you see that the Honda has basically built on great success and then developed over time? How much input do you as a team have into the direction of the bike and where it goes as far as the superbike and super sport world goes?
Well, as we know, Honda is always still the credo that the development of mass production is coming from racing side of things, so for sure they're taking in a lot from what we experience on track. We're having to fill in big reports after every round we have, so there is some input from us. On the other end, the Japanese colleagues are more than clever enough and capable enough of understanding themselves what to do as well, plus they of course have their MotoGP project going. But there is for sure input from us, but it's not like we are designing the bike.
Yeah, sure. This season, or the end of last season, here at the Kind of in Qatar, and I was very, very fortunate enough and deeply honoured to be able to speak to Nicky Hayden.
Mm-hmm.
Fans across the motorcycle world were so shocked when what happened to Nicky happened. And I think because we see them risking their lives doing a sport to entertain us week in, week out, we sometimes forget that they're subject to the daily risks that all normal people are. But as a team, if you don't mind me asking, you're not only losing a part of the team, and no doubt a friend, but how do you cope with that from a racing point of view? Because you then have to, I guess, think, well, we are in a racing business and you need to bring a replacement rider in. That must be a real difficult situation you find yourself in emotionally.
Well, it's basically already what you described to us with Nicky. We lost one of the biggest personalities in motorcycle racing. I mean, just the fan base he has and the respect he had from everywhere we came. There was always many, many people waiting for Nicky. Most of the fans just loved him. It was an honor to work with him, and also a very big pleasure to work with him, because Nicky would always give it more than 100% he had. Working with us very highly, the standards were very, very high from him, so he always wanted development on the bike, but on a fair and square way. Some things we could do on the short term, something had to be mid term, and some things long term. But he was always there with us and for us. And when he had his an accident, it was more than in the shock. We were blown away the first couple of weeks. You don't even want to think about a replacement of Nicky, because Nicky is irreplaceable.
Yeah.
So when people ask me about the replacement of Nicky, there's never a replacement for Nicky. We just bring in another rider to the team, because Nicky is once again irreplaceable. But with Nicky, we not only lost a good friend in the personality in the sport, but also a guy who was leading the development in our team. He was with us for 1 year, so he understood completely the fire blade as we had it. He understood the Pirelli tires, he understood the dynamics of the championship. And so this year he was already crucial for us to lead the development for us. So that big impact in many, many ways.
Yeah, sure. Are you able to talk about next year? Because obviously it's been announced that Leon Camus is coming to your team. Was part of the attraction of Leon, apart from being a very good rider and another hard worker, the development you've seen that he's achieved with his current team, with MV Agusta, over the last 3 years, to try and again drive that on?
Yeah, well, Leon being the single rider in the MV Agusta means all the development has to come through him or by him, or he has to judge steps forward with the team. And honestly speaking, I think he's done a great job on that. He's amazed a lot of people what he was capable of doing with the package he currently has. So that was for sure one of the aspects which was important for us. But besides that, he's in the previous years also been already on the list as one of the guys, because it seems he's just getting better and better with the age he's getting. He seems to just be getting better every year you see him riding a bike.
Yeah,
I think he's fitter than ever. He's a true professional by any means, and once again his development skills must be quite high.
Yeah, well, it was interesting because last year after I spoke to Nicky, I went across and I was able to get 15 minutes with Leon.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw the announcement, I just wondered, because they struck me as they're similar characters. They're very calm. They don't seem to get too excited or upset about things, but determined. And I mean, Nicky was famous for any test. He always did more laps than anybody else. He just would, work.
First one to come in the garage, at least half an hour before the test would start. He was ready in his leather suit with us, and he was always the last rider to leave the garage again, because you would still look at the data. You would sometimes have to say to Nicky, please get changed now, because
you're
still all sweaty stuff. Just get changed, get a drink, get some food, and come back then again. But the working ethos is extremely high. I think there's some resemblance in the riders in that point. On the other end, they're also, I think, unique personalities as they are, which every top rider is. And a top rider makes it into a top rider. In my point of view, the talent is just something which is given to you by DNA, by your mother and father, by whatever you believe, Allah, Buddha, God. But it's just a given thing that's in you. Nothing you can change on that. Then you have your career where you, when you're lucky, you end up quickly enough with the sharp end of team. So you really, your talent can be, you can take all of the potential out. Then at a certain point, it also comes down to the working ethos you have in you, your determination to succeed.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what makes the top rider into a true top rider. The difference in level what you see between riders is not, is in my belief, not strongly determined by just the talent, but a more important part is the professionality you have, the determination, your will to succeed and keep going, especially in the tough times. It's easy when it's when the wind is in the back, the sun is with us, easy sailing, go.
So it's a round.
But the real top rider steps up when he's needed.
Yeah. The second rider hasn't been announced officially. Do you know? I understand you probably can't talk too much about it.
No, I don't speak about it. There will be an announcement who the second rider is. So at this point, there's many journalists, their names circling around, and there's list, and there's speculation about. But item we prefer not to sum up a list of riders.
So
it will be quite shortly that it will be sorted out, and then you'll see the press release.
Looking back over your long time in this paddock, mm-hmm. I'm thinking you probably are the longest running team that have been in the World Superbike paddock non-stop.
Mm-hmm.
You must be, absolutely. Is the one title or one year that really stands out for you?
Thinking about the teams, Bata used to be before us, but then he left a couple of years ago. Ducati team, but that has changed over the years as well a bit. Yeah, so we are becoming a bit of a
veterans.
Paddock dinosaur. But yes, we are a long time around. It's the longest, but it's still, it is what we do. We're all about bikes. We have
of course, and
we run the dealership. We have the car, the racing product side. We have the racing team. When we're not racing, we are riding bikes ourselves.
Yeah.
And we're not doing that. We're bringing my kids to a motocross track. So as long as I can hear an engine running, I'm happy.
Yeah.
There's a smile on my face.
When I first joined the podcast in 2010 and I was signing up to all the media news emails, and I actually signed up to your racing shop product email list by mistake. So I find out, where I can get a sprocket for a CBR 600 from, which is useful because I ride a CBR 600.
Okay,
so
good on you.
But I've actually just done one track day here, and it's such a beautiful circuit.
Ah.
So smooth. But I think they extend it for track days because it takes me much, much longer to get round than anyone who's here this weekend.
So you're all around the 3-minute league?
2:34.
2:34, well, that's not so bad, I would say. Yeah, and that's during the day, so that must be hot conditions.
Yeah, the last session is under lights after the sun's gone. The first two are in the afternoon.
I didn't know they switched on the lights as well.
And we've got another one in a week's time. So that is my first for 5 years. That's my excuse. Okay. And I'm 51 and scared.
Yeah, I didn't want to ask for your age, but I could see already that you were not really really
in my side. My head, I'm 25.
That is good. That's good.
So looking back on over since 2001, ten titles you've won.
Mm-hmm.
Is the one that stands out, maybe not as a favourite, you wouldn't want to maybe pick, Chris Vermeulen or Sagan, but maybe one that was won against the odds or that you really didn't know how it was going to go to a lot. I mean, you could say James Tosin's year.
Yeah, well, James, that was the double together with Keenan Sovoglu. Being world champion in Superbike and Super Sport, which was extremely well for us. But, every year has its... Almost every year, as it charms about it.
Yeah.
Because even if I look back to last year, when we finished fourth and fifth in the championship, where the package was considered before, and by a lot of people, it's going to be extremely difficult, that we finished fourth and fifth and got podiums, won a race even with Nicky.
Yeah.
But it was also quite a delightful year for us. So it's not just determined by if you win a championship or not, because we have won 10. So it would be easy to say every time we win, it's great. It always has its uniquenesses in it. But if I have to pick one, I pick 2007, because that was just all over the place.
Yeah.
Everything was good about it.
Yeah, that was a great year.
Yeah.
Speaking of Keenan, of course, he won titles with your team.
Yep.
Has it surprised you to see him arrive here ready to race?
No.
I'm not surprised. We saw him earlier. I've been talking. There's a Turkey's Eurosport motorsport correspondent here, Chatlo Yigit, and he's friends with Keenan, and he said, if I was sat at home, I would hate.
We just spoke about talent and DNA, and what makes a top rider into a top rider is the determination, the will to win, to be there, and I mean, that's just what Keenan makes it into the top rider. The talent is, of course, huge, because otherwise he wouldn't be as quick as he was. But his desire and will to win is even more.
Yeah. It's like they need the talent to get into the paddock, to get the ride. So then what makes them a champion is the character. And
that's it.
Yeah.
They step easily onto the plate. they don't need to be asked to step on the plate.
No, and of course the other incredibly talented person in this paddock that you worked for many years with is Jonathan Ray. I'm guessing you're not surprised at his success either.
No, to be honest, not. I mean, he was having already great success with us. Unfortunately, sometimes I feel that we almost forgot to pick up a championship with him. Because the will determination was there. He had some awesome racing with us. Had a couple of doubles with us. Podiums all around. There was many trophies we won with him, and he was also one of the characters again. keep emphasizing on it. Well, you never had to ask to step on the plate. He was there. He was ready. He would give it more than 100% to ride, even when injuries were there with him. So, given that talent, I'm not surprised that he was going to be a world champion.
Absolutely. Ronald, thank you so much for talking to us. I very much look forward to next year. I'm a huge fan of your team. I'm a huge fan of Leon Cambier. Put the two together. I'm a huge fan. They done twice over.
Okay.
And if I eat many more of the cakes in the media centre, I'll just be a huge fan. But I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much. And all the best.
Thanks for that, Martin.
So, it's Martin from Motopod for the final time from this World Superbike weekend at LaSalle. And with me is Yiğit Top. Yiğit is Eurosport's Turkish commentator, and normally, of course, you are in a studio in Istanbul, but you've come across because Yiğit is also a very close friend of the incredible rider that we've seen get a podium tonight, 5 weeks after smashing himself up in Manicor, who, until I met Yiğit, I called Kenan Sofwoglu. But now I know is Kenan Sofwoglu.
Exactly.
Yiğit, thank you so much for joining us. And we've kind of become friends over this weekend.
Oh, Martin, it's incredible to be here. My past is like 14 years in commentary job. I studied Eurosport. And I had some opportunity to see race on site. 2013 MotoGP at Le Mans. And also in Istanbul Park 2013, but I didn't able to make commentary in circuit because there was a conflict between MotoGP and Superbike that weekend, and I was also doing commentary for MotoGP, and MotoGP channel didn't let me go to circuit for commentary to the public.
Right.
So I went to circuit for Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday to train a guy and to train and tell him how to do that. And I went to MotoGP for Sunday, and after MotoGP I come back to the circuit, 5 day long trip with my bike, and the next day I crashed my bike and broke my three ribs and stayed nearly 3 months at bed. But it doesn't matter. After 2 weeks of my crash, I back to commentary with great pains and with some helps.
Yeah.
By the way, if they see me. Your audience, your friends, or your listeners.
Yeah.
I am 192, right, and 172 that time, and it was very hard to carry me, but I was very keen to go to my commentary. Anyway, I found an opportunity to be here. I deeply thanks to Red Bull because we have. Good relationship in Turkey,
yeah.
And they promised me to they tell me that choose a race. Okay, I choose Harris because Harris is like a festival, and I just wanted to see a race with Spanish people with that fever.
And of course, you would have expected Kenan to have wrapped up his sixth World Supersport title,
and that's
at Jerez, and that's the
maybe.
Plan.
Yeah, that's the plan, and we could be spoilers. You could be. Celebrate, you could be happy. But the accident at France, at Manicor, they ruined all our plans. And the most important, the championship seems gone. But at Harris, I was in commentary position at Istanbul on Eurosport Studios. Sorry. Kenan was at home. And he was sending me some messages, some comments, and I was reading. And also he sent me a voice message and very, very primitive way, I put my phone to the headset. I told the technical guy, please put down the area effect.
Yeah.
And I...
So you basically held your phone's microphone to your headset microphone.
Yeah. And the people on Turkey, Eurosport listeners or audience, whatever, spectators, they heard Kenan's message before the race. After the race, look at Mayas finished fifth, and little hope, tiny hope we had inside. And after 2 or 3 minutes after finish, Kenan sent me a message. Because of the storm, the seagull, never give up off the sea. We are going to Qatar, prepare.
Right.
Then, before going to WSC, after leaving my commentary position, I called Red Bull friend Ceyda Kütükoğlu, and I told her, I'm going to Qatar, let's arrange that. Now I'm in Qatar, I'm absolutely happy because in Istanbul, in the studio, we are seeing something only what the camera show us. Here I saw many, many things. I met many, many great people. Then I have to mention it because I'm not talking with you. From the first day, you were a great friend. And you were asking too many questions about Turkish motorcycle racing, and you shared all your knowledge with me, and I didn't
That took about 2 minutes.
Sorry?
It took me about 2 minutes to share all my knowledge.
No. It's 4 days and I'm still going. And I'm not leaving this country or this circuit, whatever you call it. It's only some knowledge, it's only some warm feelings, with great happiness because motorcycle is something special.
Absolutely.
On the street, because I'm a rider too, on Istanbul, maybe the most dangerous place for riding a bike. And when we see each other, we salute each other. You never salute another car ride driver or...
No.
If you don't drive a Lancia Integrale or... You use this the same car, classical one. And yeah, I met great guys here. And the story, when I see people and I tell them that I'm from Eurosport Turkey, the first thing they ask me is Kenan. How is Kenan? How he feels?
That's a good point, actually, because our listeners are like real deep motorcycle fans, racing fans. They're the kind of guys and girls who will get every bit of information they can from every source, which is why, you know, they listen to us. And but they have a huge amount of knowledge. So to help them be even cleverer, can you just say for us Kenan's name, but in the correct...
Okay. I'm sorry, I have to check, 1, 2, 1, 2, check. Okay, sorry. Just okay. Kenan's full name.
Yeah.
Prepare. Get ready. Kenan Sofuoğlu.
Kenan Sofuoğlu.
Yes, exactly.
Now,
Kenan Sofuoğlu.
Next year, we have his protege Toprak coming up.
That's the PhD. That's PhD.
Yeah. So this is PhD level Turkish.
Because there is a...
Everyone's going to call him Toprak. He'll be like a Brazilian footballer.
Toprak is easy. Toprak is called a greo, like terre, la terre in France.
Right.
Toprak. Like gravel, not tarmac, gravel.
Got you.
Yeah.
But his surname is pronounced...
Yeah. There is a letter that you don't have in your alphabet. U.
Right.
And his family name or his surname is Toprak Razgatlıoğlu.
Okay, everyone get that? Simple.
Toprak Razgatlıoğlu.
Okay, brilliant. Look, one more thing. You told me you had an analogy for Kenan's journey to motorsport and now a 5-time world champion. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't for this year's injury, I don't think anyone, including Lucas Mahaas, doubts that it would have been 6. But you had a great analogy about Kenan being in a jungle. If you can just share that with the listeners, because
before Kenan, there was no interest in motorcycle racing in Turkey. And there was some races in Turkey. Yeah, there was some audience, there were some spectators, but not international level. Kenan was, I was always saying that they, sometimes they calling me some universities for some speech and asking me about motorsport, motorsport community, but meantime they're asking me about Kenan's journey. And I tell them with some examples, like he was just lived with a parachute. What in English? Parachute.
Yes, parachute. Yeah.
With parachute to a jungle, and there was only a machete on his hand, and he didn't know which way to go, and it was a very grift or how you say?
Dense jungle.
Yeah, dense. Yeah, dense jungle. And he started to hit to the trees and hit the leaf, the branch, and he just opened the way and he found himself till Supersport 600, and that was his, not his goal, but his strength let him only go till Supersport 600. And when he turned back and see his back, there was a road, and that road was easier for Toprak. That road, that this road was easy for Deniz and John Öncü, our twins.
The one they're going to CEV.
Yeah, they will ride for Ayo Motorsport next year.
Yeah,
and CEV, and yeah, he opened that way, that road, but it wasn't easy for him.
No,
no support from Turkish sponsors. An unknown businessman, he opened a budget for him for Yamaha R6 Cup in Germany. And after he found that budget to go to Tenkate Honda, and also his first years, his first years in Tenkate Honda wasn't so easy. I know some stories. And then after he showed his talent, he showed his passion, his abilities, they started believing in him and showing some respect. Now, after the race, Ronald Tenkate came to the garage and he said, and he hugged him and he said, "No, not bad for an old man."
Yeah.
Yeah, because when he started to his journey, to his career, the world championship career, he was young gun to young lion to prove himself. Now, now he doesn't need to prove himself to anyone because he's lifetime world champion. He is more race winner than anyone in supersport.
And I think it's also worth pointing out that we've spoken to James Whittam, Charlie Hiscard, our own Harry Lloyd, Steve English, the other guys around the media centre, Gordon Ritchie from MCN. Every single one of them say he is the nicest guy in the paddock. You could not meet a nicer guy. The nicest guy in this paddock. And it's full of really nice guys. There's guys they like, there's guys they admire.
He's Turkish. Yeah, this is the key. He can be
he's
nice.
A Turkish delight.
Yeah, not a delight. He's too hard to chew. Yeah, he's from the upper side and the northeast of the Turkey. His roots, his ancestors, and they are very very different people, and they are so tough.
Yeah,
and they are so.
Well, we've seen that tonight.
Passionate and. Kenan was growing in Sakarya, Adapazarı, in Akyazı, especially. And yes, he has that passion because he always respect to his family, elders, elders, maybe elders. He always in good relationship with the people, is treating him well. But if someone make him something unfair, he can be dangerous.
Yeah.
Not I'm dangerous, but he can.
Yeah, no,
we understand. He can show his teeth.
Yeah.
But we're not.
And it's worth also putting to bed the famous Aragon incident going down the straight where he cut up. And Kenan himself has said, "I was not trying to headbutt someone because that would really be stupid." He was shouting at. It was an American rider. I'm trying to remember who it was. Yeah.
Fabian Forey.
Ah, right. It was Forey.
Fabian Forey was also riding Kawasaki, but another team. He was trying to catch, I think, I don't remember the name of the writer.
Yeah.
He shouted, and his head shook as he was shouting because he was so angry. He needs some, he think he can pass the other rider and for Kawasaki's manufactured points. And when I was confronted at this moment in Eurosport, I say, oh, I hope I saw it wrong. And Fabian Fore, he made very, very good explanation or interview. And he said, oh, I don't think can I do something on purpose. Maybe there was some wind and the wind is shaking his head. Oh, it's very clever and very political.
Politically correct. Comment. Yeah.
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 And Kenan, he has fire.
Yeah.
That fever.
I do also have to say that I'm very grateful. Yitz made lots of efforts over this weekend to get us in to talk with Keenan. Kenan. And
thank you.
And he was kind of really willing, but before he rides, he's needed to be very focused. And after he rides, he has been in enormous pain.
He's rejected all the interviews.
Yeah. It's been the same with Eurosport, with the World Feed. So, you know, but we are very grateful for your efforts. We very much hope that we'll see you back here next year.
And also you had a chance to wish him good luck.
Yeah, we met him in the paddock earlier, and you went across to see him, and they called me over, and I got to meet him, and I asked him to be careful, and he laughed. But yeah, he was so smiley, yeah, and he's barely limping. I mean,
I'm sorry, I talked too much on live on Instagram, and talked too much cheering with my friends on the podium.
Your voice is gone.
Yeah, I lost my voice, and also I lost my voice in 2009, I think it was. America race in the USA, Minamoto Sport Park. He passed Lavati and Krasov in the last lap.
Yeah.
And it was incredible, and I lost my voice, and I couldn't do this commentary and superbike second race. I was like this, but he deserved it. He deserved it. And
next year we will
have Toprak.
Have Toprak to talk about as well.
Yeah, so Toprak is very, very fast.
Yeah.
He's very, very fast.
Well,
but the thing
as the listeners may well have already heard, James Whitterman, Charlie Hiscott, had been talking to Jonathan Ray, who was at a same test, a Kawasaki test.
In Portimao.
Yeah, with Toprak there, and he said, wow, possibly one of the most naturally gifted riders he's seen. And Jonathan Ray is a bright lad, and he's been around a long time.
Because he's a protege of Kenan.
Yeah.
Taught him too many things.
It seems very similar to Valentino Rossi and the ranch, where he's trying to bring young Italians through.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
Okay, at the moment it's just top right.
Kenan is a pioneer. He's a pioneer.
Yeah.
And the others show his footsteps. And Kenan also let John and Dennis to follow the other path to Asia Talent Cup and Red Bull Rookies Cup and Tour MotoGP. Toprak was okay with Kawasaki because he has agreement with Kawasaki, not with Team Puccetti, directly to Kawasaki, like Kenan.
Yeah.
And next year they will give him the bike exactly the same
as
Gianni Rea and Tom Sachs, because there are some rules. The satellite teams will use the same bike exactly with the factory team.
Yeah.
And today I talked with Dan Carrera, the executive producer of executive director of Superbike World Championship, also with Gregor Lavia. The new rules will help the young riders or low budget teams to fight for podium and for fight for victory. They want some action come again to Superbike.
Yeah.
But I can see easily with you when we're watching the race, both of them. I can see now it was boring. If I say, oh, it was a good race with action, I'm not a liar. And the people are listening to us, they saw it on TV, and I think there was.
It just seems a shame.
Yeah.
And
It's not Guns N' Roses' fault.
I don't mean to, no, and I don't mean to be rude to World Superbike, but we've got a MotoGP standard rider in a World Superbike paddock, and he's winning everything. And it just makes you wonder what could have been if he'd gone across.
And it's not Jonathan Ray's fault.
No, not at all.
You cannot blame him for being good, for being fast. And anyway, this is not my job to talk about that at the moment now. I'm not that expert, but I can talk about Toprak and Kenan. And Toprak, he's very clever.
Yeah.
He's a good tactician, and he can smell when he'll attack. Because I remember in two years ago, maybe three, he was riding with stock 600, and please find and watch Imola race with Kari Kazulo.
Right.
Please, and I one week ago I saw
Toprak must have been 15 or 16 then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
But but I saw in Facebook someone shared, still sharing, and when I saw the original video, it was like what the scene or viewed for more than 2,500 times.
Wow.
Yeah, and people asking who is this guy or who. Someone tells it's Toprak if on Turkey.
So it Imola 2014 or 2015?
No, maybe. I'm sorry because I'm so tired and
I can't remember.
No. It's like last year. No, 2015, Imola Superstock 600 race.
Okay.
Last three or four laps, it was incredible. No, Kari Kazulo, he is crazy also. He's a good rider, he's a fighter, but Toprak lets him, you know, surplusy in French.
Yeah. Yeet, thank you so much for spending time with us. Thank you for being such good company.
Yeah, we can book for the next year and we will do the same program, same podcast, in the same table with you, I hope.
And we will have more to talk about.
Yes, and there will be more story because Toprak will be in the championship. Toprak will show his talent, I hope, his abilities. Yeah, and if you want some Turkish light, I can bring you for the next year. And if you want some other things, you have my number, you can send me a message.
We will communicate.
Yes, exactly.
Marvelous.
Call you.
Thank you very much.
And before you close the record, I want to thank you because I came here alone. There was no Red Bull guy or someone else. I came to airport, I rent my car, I found myself my hotel, and there was only Kenan that I know when I come here. But now I have some friends, good friends, and I want to mention their name. The Turkish guy living in Qatar, Tarık Çelebi, and her lovely wife, Zeynep Çelebi, they took me and from the hotel, and last day we had a tour in Qatar. And Marco Castoli, I think. Marco Castoli, he's the sponsor of Eugene Levati. He was staying in the same hotel. We spent nearly 4 days together, and he's an incredible guy. And Ali Zengin Varol from London, Ramazan and Şenol from Germany, and they are good Turkish friends who prepare us a tea.
Right.
Turkish tea, and they give a tea to Michael Hill also. But at the end, in media center, I was sitting alone before I met you. I want to thank you because your companion, your friendship is so precious for me. And it's not easy to find a person to talk in that level about MotoGP, about Superbike, about the past of this sport in Turkey. And I'm so happy because I'm living this track with great knowledge for my profession, but for my soul and for my personality. I'm doing this track with great, great souvenirs because of you. Thank you.
That's very, very kind of you to say, but I think you summed up earlier. Motorcycles and motorcycle riders and fans are a special group.
Because we are riding wherever you ride, in city, in suburban, in the village, in the mountains, we are riding in the same earth, under the same sun, under the same rain. You can ride a chopper, I can ride a maxi scooter, she can ride a racing, and he can ride an enduro. But when we fall down, we fell down to the same place, the same gravel.
And we understand each other.
Yeah, and we understand each other.
Thank That's you. It. Thank you. You. Okie doke. So, thank you very much indeed to Yeet, and before that, Ronald Tankata, and we hope to speak to both those gentlemen again in the future. It has been a fantastic and surprising season. Some brilliant racing across the board in British Superbikes, but especially in Moto3 and MotoGP, Moto2, hoping for an improvement next year in the, you know, minute-by-minute excitement level. World Superbikes, well, we discussed it at length in the interviews with James Whittam and Charlie Scott, and especially Scott Smart, and Stephen and Harry. How do you make it more exciting without unfairly punishing Johnny Ray for being an incredibly good rider? Don't know. Watch this space.
Well, that was the one thing I heard in that interview that kind of confused me a little bit, was they had talked about, well, you can't arbitrarily penalize one bike over another bike. And so that's kind of like why they weren't going with a weight limit or air restrictors. But then they go and they say, well, we're going to put a rev limiter in there. I'm like, well, isn't that just doing the same thing?
It is, but what they've said is it's basically to limit, and it's only going to be applied to Ducati and Kawasaki initially. Yamaha, it won't affect because they haven't had the results. It's going to stop them investing huge amounts of money, which both those teams have relative to a lot of the other teams in the paddock, to keep increasing. Now, apparently Kawasaki have said it doesn't hugely bother us because we don't actually hit that limit on many tracks. It will have an effect at some, but it's to stop them stretching the gap even further and, you know, developing a bike that revs to 17 or 18,000 or whatever. So it's more a, we're just going to hold you where you are and let the others catch a bit, then we're actually going to slow you down and penalise with artificial weight things that, I mean, remember Troy Bayliss getting kilograms thrown on his bike. So I see the sense behind it, but as Scott Smart said so succinctly, people say, no, that's not fair, you can't penalise someone for being a great rider, you just need to make the racing more exciting. Well, you can't do both. You know, you can have one, you can have both. You can penalise someone and make the race more exciting, or don't penalise them and accept that, well, Johnny's just going to win everything. And you know, we keep saying you can't blame Johnny Ray for being that bit better than everyone else in the paddock. As James said, if he wasn't there, that would have been a close season. Because Chaz and Tom were tied for second place going into that last round. So, yeah, I don't know.
They had to do something.
And, of course,
they had to do something. I mean, just to close it back up. So, I mean, I'm all for anything that they put in there. I kind of thought it was just sort of talking out of one side of your mouth or calling a kettle black there a little bit. But I'm not the guy designing the rules. I'm just the guy listening to what was said.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. I also found myself this season a couple of times watching a race, especially race two, where generally Johnny's starting from ninth because he's won the first race, and three quarters of the way through the first lap he's in the lead, and I just find myself getting my Kindle out and reading a book with it on in the background because I thought, well, that's it, race done. And often, sadly, it was. Now, of course, one thing we do have to wrap up with is the MCN Fantasy League, and I'm pretty sure for the first time I might be doing Jules a disservice. Jules might have won this one year. I mean, our league, not the overall thing. But Andrew Course, Motopod host, has won with Course Equip, beating Jim O'Mahony and Team Grizzly, just 27 points in the end to the Motopod title. I think Andrew's about 20th overall, so incredibly good result. Alex Samara came third with 4 Lex SA Califat 77 was his team. With the rest of the hosts, I was comfortably a long way behind in 12th with Mid-Desert Donuts. Harry was 36th, Dave was 45th, Scott was 69th, and Skyler was 103rd. But Dave claims that he doesn't even look at the team and do any transfers through an entire season, in which case actually coming 45th was pretty respectable. And you guys are going to have to get yourselves back into it or into it next season, because it's tremendous fun. Maybe not.
Yeah, I have never done it, so I'm going to have to try to, beginning of the year, jump in and see if I can do any good.
Well, in the first year it was running, the winner, overall winner, got an R1. The next year it was an R6. The year after that it was an R125, I think. One of our listeners did win a bike, but then after that it went to tyres, and now I think it's just two tickets to the GP round of your choice. So, you can see the budget being crunched. Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for coming on and talking with me, Martin. It was a real pleasure.